With that, I'm going to bring up our first speaker, who does lots of service. I see her all over the place, Annabelle. From the Annabelle from the Decision Group in West Hempstead. Thank you.
Where's Dean?
We didn't think anybody knew. Okay.
I thought I had one more act before I went up.
Sorry.
Good morning, I'm Annabelle, alcoholic. What a privilege it is to be here with all of you this morning, to be sober thanks to the program of AA, to be able to tie my shoes this morning without anybody reminding me I should put my pants on before I do put the shoes on. I've been focused on steps 8 and 9 recently. Those are the ones where you think about who should have put me on their list to make amends to, and why haven't they come to me yet to make those amends. And I was on the phone with my sister yesterday discussing that. You know, we both have somebody who really should have made amends to us by now. While we were talking, the conversation took us back to our childhood and then young adulthood and then the insanity of my active alcoholism and drug use. And I said, you know what, Kathy? I never did make amends to you. I did make amends to her, but I forgot about this piece. I said, when I moved into your house with my son before I got sober and just took over your living room and ate your food and let you help me take care of my child because I was escaping from my own house. I never thanked you for that. But you were a safe place for me. Somehow I must have known in my insanity that your home would be a safe place for me and for my son. And she said, you don't have to thank me for that. That's what we do for each other. Now, she never moved herself with her children into my house. But that's what I did. Honestly, I have no idea how long we were there. I don't know. People came and went. I think she was working. Gee whiz, it was really a low point in my life. All I do know is, however long we were there, days or weeks, I don't think my son or I ever used the bathtub or the shower, and yet my sister just let us be there. My home wasn't safe at that time. When I was out there, I got into a marriage with somebody who turned out to be a violently abusive person toward me and toward our son. And I was drinking, I was using. I really had very low self-esteem. And one thing I do remember happened during that period of time where my son and I were staying at my sister's house was one day, car pulled up. It was my father's car. And he had invited one of my friends who's not in recovery. He was a part-time alcoholic, a drug addict, social. And brought him along, and my then husband was there in the car. There might have been somebody else in the car, and they told me to go out into the car. I was terrified. I was trembling. I thought they had come, and they were going to take me someplace to kill me. The paranoia was so intense for me for quite a period of time. I really thought they were going to kill me. How I thought my father, who I knew loved me, was going to drive me someplace where my life was going to be terminated, I don't know, but I was really sure. Somehow they got me into that car. Maybe they offered me candy or cigarettes or something. So I get into the car, and we drove off, and I was sitting in the back seat near one of the doors, and as we got on, I didn't know where we were going. They may have, I don't think anybody told me, but anyway. We drove and we were on maybe the Grand Central Parkway, I don't know what, and And I yelled, I said, oh my God, we got to turn back. All those cars are following us. And my father yelled at me. He was starting to lose his patience. And he said, what do you mean they're following us? I said, all those white cars, don't you see them circling this car? They're on the left, they're on the right, they're in front of us, they're behind us. We're never going to, they're going to stop us. They're going to, I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but all those cars were following us. And he yelled at me and told me to be quiet. He didn't, those weren't his words, of course. And he said, you're just not that important. All of those cars are not following you, following us. And but I was terrified, and I opened the door, and I tried to jump out of the car. And somebody reached over and pulled the car and got me in. And then my husband at the time punched me and moved, rearranged the seating somehow so I didn't have access to any more door handles. And by the time we got to Union City, New Jersey, to some storefront that sold a lot of candles and things like that, we went downstairs, and still nobody explained anything to me, but after the fact, I knew that was my first exorcism, right? And it was important that they bring my friend Ernie along because he spoke Spanish, and my ex-husband was a native Spanish speaker as well. And there were some incantations and dances, and there was a chicken that was squawking, and then they had me partially undressed and turn around, and at the end of the thing, and of course I was drunk and high and everything else, I had not stopped doing anything along those lines. I was getting dizzy. And when this whole thing was over, and I was allowed to put my clothes back on and we were leaving, they gave my husband a big garbage bag that had all of the fallout, I guess, from this exorcism. And the carcass of the chicken who had stopped clucking during the procedure. And they told us exactly what road we had to take and where they were supposed to dump this bag, right, for spiritual purposes, so that everything would set properly, so that it would really work. And I remember the being told that when they dumped this bag on the side of the road at the designated spot, the important thing was not to turn back and look. You just move forward with your life. You drive forward. So we're all packed back in this car, all of these people plus this bag, right? And we could tell from, even I could tell through my haze, where we were supposed to throw that bag, because there was a little mountain on the side of the road of these black garbage bags. And so my husband reached out the window, threw the bag on top of the heap. And as we drove off, like Lot's wife, I turned my head just to see our bag on top of the heap. Oh boy, did I get a beating after that one. All of the trouble everybody went to, all of the money, this had to be paid for in cash. I mean, everything spoiled because I had to turn my head and look. So that's where I was, right? That's part of where my use of alcohol and drugs took me, right, to a place like that. And that was only my first exorcism. And that was the only time I remember moving in with my sister, with my little son. I started drinking at a very young age. The first time I got really drunk, I was 7 years old. It was at a family function, somebody's wedding, that I could have spoiled, really, except they dragged me out and put me to bed. And I wasn't a daily drinker from that young age, but I would drink whenever I could. And I got away with a lot of crazy behavior because I was able to play different roles at the same time. I was able to be the good student. I was able to be polite and help out if my parents entertained. The neighbors, I don't think, knew too much about how crazy I was. And besides, my brothers, my older brothers, their fires burned a lot brighter than mine. Because when they were drunk, when they acted out, there was property damage, there were ambulances, there was legal, you know, there was police and everything else. And My insanity, as crazy as it was, didn't bring on all those cars with flashing lights most of the time. So I got away with this crazy behavior, and as I got older, I just drank more, and when I had some money in my pocket, I was able to designate what brand of this or that I was going to drink. And then the drugs were a big part of my story. Just offer me something and I'll take it. I never asked anybody what's in that or how many are you supposed to do, or but I already did this or that, what's the interaction going to be? Don't give me any vitamins or supplements today because, you know, I don't do that to my body. You know, I'm not sure. I have to know everything about this or that. But boy, oh boy, you know, most of my life, when did I start? Oh my goodness. Okay. So I got older, I went through school, I wound up marrying somebody for probably all the wrong reasons. I don't regret the marriage because as a result, I had my son. And, you know, as anybody who knows me knows, I'm not one of those women who can come up here and say, well, I'm a real alcoholic. But of course, when I was pregnant with my child, I stopped drinking for 9 months, and boy, I couldn't wait to start drinking after. I didn't stop drinking for anything ever. I never tried to stop. I'm sure I tried to slow down a little bit, especially when I was noticeably pregnant and went to firm functions. I didn't want them to know I was drinking a lot, and I did use something less. But if there's something I could do differently, really, if I had to pick one thing, I know what it is. And today's his birthday. So I went to school for a lot of different years, and somehow, despite, you know, like this haze, like remember Pigpen, right, from Schultz, I had this just haze around me all of my life, and it took a long, you know, this drunken drug, this and that, I still managed to do very well and get through school and that school and this and that, and I wound up getting a job that really anybody in my field would have been envious of. I had a beautiful window office and was making a lot of money, and I was on a track to, you know, be one of those masters of the universe. And, you know, and after a few, yeah, so during my tenure at that place, at, you know, during that job, I wound up having to take several very long leaves of absence to spend time in mental hospitals, right? Because I wasn't acting right, I was dangerous to myself and others. And at one point, I remember being called into the corner office, and all of the decision makers in the firm were in that corner office, and there were probably 8 or 9 of them, and they told me that it was time for me to leave. And I didn't offer up any excuse, I didn't ask why, nothing of that, because, you know, to me it was sort of a miracle that they hadn't kicked me out sooner. But, you know, and I still didn't want to be fired. Who wants to be asked to leave a job, you know, that you rely on? So anyway, with my tail between my legs, I walked down the hall, I went to my office, and I went to the computer to download my personal contacts, and I had already been shut off from the whole computer system. It wouldn't turn on with my password anymore, and I threw the few things that I had around the office into some paper shopping bags that I could find, and I went downstairs and I called the car service, the firm's car service, to come take me home. I was working in Manhattan and lived out on Long Island. And so I'm waiting downstairs for this car to come with my bags of whatever, and it started to drizzle. And I thought, where is that car? And then it started to rain, and it started to pour, and I realized as these bags disintegrated and my belongings were, you know, falling to the ground, that, you know, they cut me off from the computer. They weren't sending a car to take me anywhere. I'm slow, right? So somehow I got home. I must have taken a whatever, subway, railroad, bus, whatever it was, I got home. And I was worried about being home because my salary, I made more money than my husband did at the time, and it was my salary that paid the nanny. We had somebody who slept in 4 or 5 nights a week to help take care of the baby. And I knew we were gonna have to let her go right away. And even worse than that, somebody else was gonna have to take care of that baby. And tough, you know. So I called my older brother, who's no longer with us, but I knew that he had been going to AA. I did not know at the time what the A's stood for in AA. I had no idea. But I heard the scuttlebutt in the family that Roger went to AA and he had cleaned up his act and wasn't drinking, or at least it wasn't causing him problems anymore. And so I called Roger and I said, you know, I lost my job. I've been drinking a little bit too much. One of the understatements of my life. And he said, well, call the intergroup in your area and ask them if they have a meeting for professionals. I didn't know what intergroup was. I knew I was a professional. I don't know how I got the phone number for intergroup. I don't have a clue. I don't know when I called. But at some point after that day, I called NASA Intergroup, and a very kind and polite volunteer alcoholic answered the phone, and I asked that question that Roger had given me, do you have any meetings for professionals? And you told me, here in Nassau County, we have meetings every day of the week, round the clock, and everybody's welcome, even professionals. And honestly, I didn't know what to do with that. What am I gonna do? So I keep drinking, I keep using. The baby and I weren't getting along that well. My husband was going to work. It was a disaster. I don't know how I got to my first AA meeting. I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. But I do remember my first meeting was at the First Presbyterian Church in Mineola, and it was upstairs, one of those rare meeting rooms that was not downstairs. Upstairs with windows, and the room was packed, and a very nice looking, clean, right, neat woman came out, and she introduced herself to me and asked me my name, and I told her my name, and she found a seat for me in this packed room, and I was sitting near people, like people didn't give me a berth like they really should have, certainly if I was on the subway, because I wasn't bathing. I was wearing the only dress that fit me that I kept closed with a big safety pin over my belly, and my hair, you know, I never thought of fixing my hair or washing it. And after the meeting, I don't know what you guys were talking about, but somehow I was able to sit in that meeting, I guess. And after the meeting, that same woman, the greeter, right, the greeter, rushed over to me, remembered my name, said, Annabelle, it was so nice to meet you. I hope you'll come back again tomorrow. She planted the seed. So early on, even in the depths of my alcoholism, not knowing what I was doing or why, people doing service in AA drew me in, right? By calling intergroup, by this woman serving as a greeter. So I continued to drink, of course. I mean, I went to the meetings because there was something, yeah, I didn't have any, basically I wasn't working. I had nothing else to do. My family was desperate for me to make some changes and get better. And it was 2 hours in the middle of the day where I didn't have to take care of the child that I really didn't know how to take care of. I wasn't born with any nurturing skills, right, that I knew of. I found out later, it just took years of sobriety for me to uncover and unearth them, right? Because today I'm a really good mother. So, anyway, after months of attending this meeting and oversharing, absolutely, I told you things I wouldn't tell my best friend, right? And you just listened and acted as if that's okay. But nobody else was sharing on that graphic level at that meeting. And one day, like a lot of other days, I was drunk My husband got mad at me, and he beat me, and he broke some toys over my head, and he kicked me down the steps, and he punched me, and somehow, some of that message I had heard at the AA meeting came to me. Some of you must have said, nobody deserves to be beaten. And so I tried to call the police, and he ripped the phone off the wall. And then I went around the corner to my mother's house, and I said, Mom, I've really had it. I need to get rid of this man. I can't live like this anymore. And she said, Annie, sit down. Look at you. Look at your hair. He's a man. You're a woman. You're not even wearing lipstick. Lipstick? She said, you got to fix yourself. I'll make you a cup of tea. No, I don't want tea. I want to call the police because my phone's not working anymore. She said, but if you call the police, you may lose that man. And I said, oh, yeah, you're right. And I wound up going home and begging this man to give me another chance. This is how well I was working. My mind was working. Please give me another chance. Look at you. You're a disgusting this, that, and whatever, right? I try not to say bad things about myself anymore. I've heard too many bad things said about me for too many years. And I said, no, no, it's going to be fine. I won't drink anymore. I think that was the first time I ever used that line on anyone. He said, don't tell me, tell God. Tell God. Get on your knees and tell God you're not going to drink anymore. So here I am drunk, 100 pounds overweight, beaten. I get down on my knees. And I say, why am I on my knees? You're asking God, you're telling God that you're going to stop drinking. And I said, dear God, I promise I'm not going to drink anymore. And I tried to get up thinking that was it. And he said, oh, no. And you promised God you're not going to do any more drugs. And and you're not going to smoke cigarettes anymore. And you're going to lose weight. And you're going to keep the baby clean and wash the house and sexual favors and this and that. And I promised this man the world, right? And I keeled over, I threw up, I passed out. And when I came to the next morning, I said, oh, Bertie, you're going to be late for work because I needed a drink. He said, oh, no, I'm not going to work today. You promised you were going to clean the house. Clean the house. And that man, I didn't see any kids here today. That man rode my ass all day long, making sure that I cleaned the house. He introduced me to the vacuum cleaner. He showed me where he kept the mop. He helped me figure out how to use the washing machine, all of these things. And for one whole day with this man on my, not taking me out of his sight, I sort of cleaned the house and took care of the kid. And most importantly, that was the first day in many years that I didn't have a drink or a drug. And it took me years, years in this program before I could look back at that man with anything but resentment and anger. And at some point, I don't know, maybe in year 5 or 6, I was able to realize that I had gratitude for him, because I don't know that I ever would have tried to stop drinking. I don't know. I never tried. I never thought that there was a way for me to live life without alcohol or drugs. And so I stopped drinking, and I kept going to that meeting. And you guys told me, I guess you noticed a change after I had stopped drinking after a little while. You suggested that I get a home group and a commitment and a sponsor. I had no idea what a sponsor was, but somebody volunteered to be my sponsor, and I called her in the morning, and you gave me the greeting commitment. That was my first commitment in AA, and I was told to stand out in front of the church, big church, and as people came in to say, hi, I'm Annabelle, welcome to the Franklin Square Decision Group. And I got very frustrated because nobody gave me the time it took to say all of that to anybody. They would rush past me. They were more interested in what their friends had to say. They wanted to get coffee. Nobody really wanted to stand still and give me... I tried. I really did try. And then I gave up. And I went to tender my resignation. I said, I can't do this. I can't do it. I can't do it. And so you made the job easier for me. You said, just stand out there, maybe smile, maybe not, offer your name, try to shake a hand. If people get by you, it's okay, it's all good, right? It's the effort, not the outcome that you're to be concerned with. And I was able to do it, and I was the greeter. And over the years, I've filled every role that a home group needs help with, right? And of late, I guess I do less service work at my home group than I used to because I'm more involved with service beyond the home group, right? I still work, I still have other responsibilities. You know, we get sober so that we can live a life outside of AA, but I try never to forget that it's my AA service commitments that have to come first, because after that comes the good life that I enjoy. So I went on through getting sober and doing service. I remember at when the time that COVID hit, I was serving as DCMC of Nassau County General Service, and that's basically chairing the Nassau chapter of General Service. And that commitment really helped me a lot because I was in a panic over COVID. I wound up staying upstate in my place quite a bit alone. And I would remember, oh yeah, but you have to do this and you have to do that. And I really enhanced my technical skills and learned how to do Zoom like a lot of you, you know, like we all really changed up our programs and learned new skills and abilities. And if I didn't have a service commitment and if I was just thinking about me, it would have been much harder for me to get through that period of time. It really would have, because COVID, you know, gave me personal fear and affected my business at the time. You know, that's one of the things I'm so grateful for that AA has given me back the ability to work in the area that I'm trained to work, right? When I first got sober, shortly after, I remember my first sober job, because my dad was begging me to get a job, you know, in my field, and I really didn't feel ready for it at all. But I did wind up getting a job cold calling for an insurance company part-time, and then I did sort of office work for them, for an insurance company, and my other part-time job was working for a termite exterminating company, doing cold calls to people, trying to sell them our exterminating services. And I would sit at my desk. It was a converted home, not really well converted, but it was like a house where we worked and made calls to people who didn't want to hear from us. And for $5 cash an hour, I would call people and offer them our services. And I remember one day on that job, I had my handbag on the floor, on the rug, and I saw a roach crawling out of one of my coworkers, out of her bag, and across the rug. And I said, oh my God, that might crawl into my bag. And so here we are working in this exterminating company. And I said, you know, I gotta do better than this. I really But the jobs, that combination of sober employment worked for me for a period of time, because with that money that I made from these jobs, I was able to pay the babysitter and to buy myself a carton of cigarettes every week. And those were my priorities, right? I went to meetings, I smoked, and I made sure the baby was properly minded. Those were my priorities. And as time went on, you know, I'm not gonna make you listen to the whole history of my journey from those types of sober jobs to other types of sober jobs to where I am today. Sometimes I get dressed in the morning and I can't believe where I'm going or what I'm doing. That people trust me and want to hear what I have to say. That I feel like I'm as good as the people I used to be terrified of. right? Because I am. We all are. So yeah, so COVID, that DCMC position helped me quite a bit. And I got involved in Southeast New York too. I think listen, I used to drink a lot, so my memory's not what it could have been. But I think my first position for Southeast New York was chairing the Accessibilities Committee. I remember doing that and really getting a lot of that. It taught me a lot about how to be considerate of people who have different abilities and, you know, different perceptions and abilities at meetings, and the importance of making sure that AA is open and inclusive to everybody, whether your disability or special need is something that, you know, affects the way you walk or the way you move or the way you feel, right? It, you know, really doesn't matter. There's all kinds of doors to accessibility out there. And that was a great training ground for me. And then I had the pleasure of serving as chair of NASA Intergroup and met a lot of really wonderful people getting back involved with that. Previously, of course, I had been GSR and Intergroup rep and done all of those types of jobs. And today I have the privilege of serving again as a chair of a CINI committee, cooperation with the professional community, which has special meaning for me because I know that some legal professionals, when it's suspected that they might have a drinking problem, are offered an opportunity by their firm to go to a rehab or a detox or to speak to a counselor. And there wasn't anything like that offered to me. Maybe they just thought I was crazy, but I think they knew I had a problem because I'm not going to talk about what I did on the job. I almost did. But yeah, so nobody offered me that. So today, one of the things that I take very seriously is trying to make sure that I can help other people in my field find their way to recovery through AA, the way I eventually found it. So cooperation with the professional community, I just give a plug, we have a workshop coming up on September 7th, gonna be in Whitestone, and it's gonna be a joint workshop with the public information group as well. So anyway, that's coming up. That's my current position. I try to stay active in AA service. It's critical for me. And it's not because, I know this for sure, it's not because anything that I have to offer any professional in AA or any member of the public who has alcoholism is going to be special or necessarily make a difference. It's because I need to keep learning how to get along with other people. I need to keep learning and practicing these principles so that I feel okay when I get up in the morning and have the courage to go through my day. Lots of people who look strong and capable on the outside are riddled with fear and insecurity on the inside. And then what I came to realize is sometimes those people who look the strongest and most capable are the people who really need a gentle touch more than anybody else. So I want to be the hand of AA, right? We are responsible. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. Thanks for letting me share.